the Lord God commanded the man, "You are free to eat from any tree in the garden, but you must not eat from the tree of knowledge of good and evil. But when you eat from it, you will certainly die."
Many of our doctrines about sin and salvation are based on a particular reading of the Eden story, in particular in Genesis 3. So the Calvinist and Augustinian doctrines of the total depravity of humanity, the universal sinfulness of humanity, they're really built on that story. The sin aspect of that story is really just in the top layer. It is in the retelling of an Elohim story that the sin story has been layered on top. The story of the snake and Yahweh and the man and the woman and the fruit in the garden in Genesis 3 is really a retelling of the story of the struggle between Enlil and Enki in the Babylonian story of origins. They were the original players who conflicted over how intelligent human beings should be, how healthy, how long-lived, how many of them there should be, all the punishments of struggling to get enough food to eat and then struggling in childbirth. They are all there in the Babylonian story. And when we go to the original, sin and salvation, they are not part of that story at all. The moral behavior that we find in the original texts is the moral behavior of the Anunnaki. It's the morality of Enlil and Enki that is really in question in that story. And it's only the retelling of the story by a later Yahwist writer that it becomes a story about human sinfulness and salvation. And it's sort of pasted over the top as a gloss over the earlier story. I think it's really important to dismantle those Augustinian and Calvinist doctrines, because they're not even good theology based on the current form of Genesis 3, if you read it closely enough. But as soon as you realize that the original version of this story is about paleo contact, you realize, oh, okay, human sinfulness had nothing to do with the dramas being described and reflected on in this text. So yes, I think it changes everything.
And the Lord God commanded the man, "You are free to eat from any tree in the garden, but you must not eat from the tree of knowledge of good and evil. But when you eat from it, you will certainly die." The serpent said, "You certainly won't die. God knows that when you eat it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, with knowledge of good and evil." When the woman saw that the fruit of the tree was good for food, and pleasing to the eye, and also desirable for gaining wisdom, she took some and ate it. She also gave some to her husband, who was with her, and he ate it. Then the eyes of both were opened, and the Lord God said, "The human has now become like one of us, with knowledge of good and evil. He must not be allowed to reach out his hand and take also from the tree of life, and so live forever." So the Lord God banished him from the Garden of Eden, and placed at the entrance to the garden cherubim with a flaming sword flashing back and forth to guard the way to the tree of life.
Any pastor who's got a theological degree will know things that many people in the churches don't know, because this information never finds its way into sermons. Well, I think the question about the Vatican is that sort of on a grander scale. Of course, the Vatican knows things. And I would come to that conclusion just through looking at history, really. So when the church was putting forward its Index Librorum Prohibitorum, this was a great list of books that the faithful were not allowed to read, but the Vatican's theologians had read them because they had assessed them and decided they shouldn't be read. So all those books will be in the Vatican Library. All the books that were not burned but sequestered during periods of colonization, they'll be there. All the information that I've referenced earlier when I said that pastors who have a theological degree will know 80% of what I'm saying and agree with 80% of it. Well, that knowledge is there on steroids in the Vatican Library, because they have had top scholars, top theologians working on these questions, as the colloquium illustrates, for a very long time. So information that's not been for public consumption has been in those libraries. And since the Roman Catholic Church was an integral part of the conquest and colonization of many countries around the world, not only are you likely to have works of art and works of literature, you're likely to have artifacts as well from other cultures, which speak to different stories of origins, a different explanation of our place in the cosmos. So they've got all that. They've got the information that came with the famous Fatima sighting at the beginning of the 20th century. So there's heaps of information that's not for public consumption. And I would say they will know at least as much as I do, and I'm sure a heap beside. I'm not a Roman Catholic. I've never worked for the Roman Catholic Church, so I don't have privileged access. But I would just connect those dots and say, well, yes, of course, there's information there, just as every national government will have information that is not something that the public has access to. There will be secrets. Given what we know about the processes of conquest and colonization, the burning and sequestration of books, the deletion and replacing of old narratives, indigenous narratives, the reading, assessing, and forbidding of people who had produced all those forbidden books, I think there'll be a heap of interesting information to be read in the Vatican Library. The Bible itself shows how the memory of the plural Elohim was masked as the Jewish scriptures were coming together, as Judaism was going through a ritual reform. This was in the time of Kings Hezekiah and his grandson Josiah, in the time of the high priest Hilkiah, or scribe Shaphan, and the senior priest Ezra. If you follow those stories through the Bible, you will see that they intended the Jewish people to regard Yahweh as the only true God, and all the other Elohim are false gods or idols or ideas. They're not really real, except the way the narrative shift is recalled by the Bible, it ensures that any attentive reader of the Bible will never be able to miss that the other Elohim were just as real as Yahweh was, that Yahweh was one of a number, that he was one of the Tseva Hashemayim, the airborne armies, that he was one of a number of beings on the Ba'adat El, the Council of Power.
Moses said to God, "Behold, I shall go forth to the children of Israel, and I shall say to them, the powerful one of our fathers has sent me to you, and they will ask me, what is his name? What shall I say to them?" And the powerful one spoke to Moses, saying, "Legon ego eimi ho'on. Tell them I am the being. Say this to the children of Israel, the being has sent me to you." What kind of being is that? Maybe there is a clue in the Tetragrammaton, these four letters that have become used as the holy name for God. This was the name that the being began using of himself in the very next sentence. So the very next sentence begins, "And moreover, the powerful one said to Moses." So again, there's that equation. Yahweh is a powerful one in conversation with Moses. "And moreover, the powerful one said to Moses, say this to the children of Israel, Yahweh Elohe of your fathers, the Elohe of Abraham, the Elohe of Isaac, the Elohe of Jacob has sent me to you." So he's describing himself as an Elohe, as an Elohim. He's using this name Yahweh, and it's represented by these four letters, the Tetragrammaton. In Numbers 31:17, where following a battle, Yahweh has demanded 675 sheep and goats, 72 cattle, 61 donkeys,
32 virgin girls, and 420 pounds of gold. Now that's for him. The human beings can keep the rest, he says. And you might think, oh, when it says that's for him, presumably that's actually to sustain the priestly families. That's really virgin girls to be used by the priestly families, beef for the priestly families, gold for the priestly families. Except that's not how the story is told. And in fact, when you get to the Septuagint and you read the book of Bel and the Dragon, there's a very clear distinction made between the Babylonian culture, who pretend that they have an entity that needs gold and cattle and virgin girls, but it's really the priests who are enjoying all these. That culture's made fun of because that is not the pattern of the people of Israel. The priests are not pretending. They really do have a powerful one that demands all this tribute. And his name is Yahweh.
The suppression was, yes, for religious reasons, because it was about the Yahwist high priesthood getting rid of all the other priesthoods. So now there's only one sort of ministry of truth, and it's the Jerusalem high priestly family, their practices, their teachings, and all the priesthoods of Dagon, Chemosh, Milcom, Asherah, they've all been gotten rid of. Their temples have been gotten rid of, their altars have been destroyed, figurines broken. So yes, for religious reasons, for civic reasons as well, because it was really a centralization of power and wealth as well. All the tithes are now going to come to the only temple there is, the one in Jerusalem. So you've got one God, one king, one high priest, one royal temple. So yes, for religious reasons, the Elohim's involvement in it. But that's an intriguing question, because I think if we look at the present day, the current pattern of non-disclosure, I think, is not only decided at a human level, that we are not the only ones in this equation. It's not just a matter of kings and princes and prime ministers and presidents deciding not to tell people what's going on. I think there are bigger forces at play that, in general, keep the public in the dark as to what contact is happening right now, what technology is being shared, so on and so forth. If that is true now, then it's entirely possible that it was true in the past. But when we look at the biblical stories, I think Yahweh, for instance, was very keen on making his presence felt even after that time of direct rule, which ends in 1 Samuel 8. He still wants his wishes to be observed by the human rulers who follow. And so I wonder if there was a bit of a transitional period there, but I think our ancestors' stories give us a lens through which to understand the present, through which to understand the world. And if we take our ancestral stories seriously, then human beings are not the most powerful in the decision-making matrix. So I think today, yes, the Elohim are involved in their lack of public profile, if I can put it that way.
Hi, Paul. I've been thinking about the idea of mass amnesia. Could the reason we've forgotten our true origins be that we were made to forget through trauma or manipulation?
Well, I think there are a number of reasons why we've forgotten our origins, and a lot has to do with the exporting of monotheistic religion, which generally deletes and replaces the indigenous story that holds all that knowledge, that holds all that information. So I think the forgetting has not been accidental. It's been very deliberate. I talked earlier about that 100-year period of trying to prevent indigenous initiations from happening from 1880 through to the 1980s. I think the stamping out of pre-Christian story in Central and South America was very deliberate. The burning of the Mayan libraries, very deliberate. The censoring of people who wanted to speak about populated universe. I'm talking about people like Giordano Bruno in 1600, burned at the stake because he's talking about a populated universe.
Something filthy and blooded is being dragged through the streets of Rome as crowds of people look on. Armed papal officers stand at the street corners, encouraging the crowds to cheer as the object is dragged before them into the market square. The object is a naked man. He has been in prison for 7 years. Few would recognize him as the charismatic scholar and speaker who had dazzled Europe only a few years before with his speaking tours. A friar of the Dominican order, his public demonstrations of phenomenal mental skills and his books on mental self-improvement and mnemonics had made him a popular figure in a Europe hungry for new ideas. Now, he is an object of horror. The papal guards unchain the man and fix him on a stake, upside down. One guard now pulls the man's tongue forward out of his mouth and nails it to the stake. Next, he draws a knife from its scabbard and uses it to sever the man's tongue. Other officers of the church now step forward to ignite the pyre positioned below the man's head. The crowd watches in fearful approval as Giordano Bruno goes up in flames. It is Ash Wednesday. Giordano Bruno had been held in prison for 7 years without trial in the vain hope that he might recant his heretical ideas. Such a recantation would break the spell of his popularity among a public who had flocked to his lectures and demonstrations of mental skills. It would serve as a warning to Christians throughout Europe not to stray too far from Catholic orthodoxy. In the absence of a recantation, a trial has been hurried through to allow for his public execution, which will send shockwaves through Christendom for decades to come and leave people in no doubt that the ideas of Giordano Bruno are ideas to be avoided at every possible cost.
So the forgetting's not been accidental. It's been a deliberate policy. But I think there's another layer to the story too. There was a cataclysm from which humanity recovered, which has generated a lot of stories of origins around the world. And I would suggest that the story of the sons of Sanabua, told by the Edo and Yoruba people of Nigeria and Cameroon, the Tagalog story from the Philippines, the story of the Ruach over the floodwaters in the Bible, the feathered serpents hovering over the floodwaters in the Popol Vuh, the winds that do the terraforming in the Babylonian story. I would suggest they are all describing the rehabilitation of our planet post-cataclysm.
The Edo people of southern Nigeria and Benin tell a story from the dawn of time. In it, the sons of Osanabua arrive on planet Earth. They are beings who arrive from outer space to a planet that is entirely covered by water. Their task is to terraform it. After they have cleared the waters from the higher ground, their leader and father, Osanabua, appears in the sky and descends from what appears to be a chain stretching as far as the eye can see into the heavens. Osanabua then delegates to his sons all the subtle works of terraforming the planet ready for human society. The Elohim, the powerful ones, arrive over the dark flood waters of the planet in a ruach. The word ruach is popularly translated as the Spirit of God, and in later texts in the Bible, it appears to be used in that way. In its first mention in Genesis, the text specifies that the ruach was hovering. The word for hovering, melehefet, is the word the Bible uses to describe how birds of prey hover in the sky, appearing to float in the air without moving their wings. This is what the powerful one's ruach was doing. It was hovering in the sky without moving any wings. Mauro Biglino is a scholar of ancient Hebrew. For many years, he worked for the St. Paul Press in Rome, translating with great precision the literal meaning of Hebrew words for Vatican-approved interlinear Bibles. providing the interlinear meaning, is a very exact discipline. The scholar must be rigorous in avoiding any kind of interpretation of the word and give only the literal etymological meaning of each word part. So it is with that degree of precision that Mauro Bellino explains in his writings that the use of the word ruach in Hebrew literature shows that the word means either a wind or something flying through the air and creating a strong wind. This meaning has survived to this day in the Ethiopian Amharic word roha. It means a fan or anything that moves through the air and creates a wind.
External help in that moment to help us as a species recover from cataclysm. And I think that was so traumatic that it becomes the thing we don't speak of. And so a lot of indigenous story begins with recovery, with only a very scant explanation of what it is we're recovering from. And that might simply be because it was so traumatic. We don't want to go there. We don't want to talk about it. But there is something psychological that trauma does, that when people are traumatized, they can forget the thing that traumatized them through how our minds and our brains work. And it may be that works at a collective level as well, that we really did emerge in a state of shock from what had just happened to our planet and our species. And that's why we don't tell the stories of what went before, because we don't really remember it. We don't remember it clearly. And there is a sort of agreement, certainly if you listen to Aboriginal Australian story, I think there's a kind of cultural agreement that we don't talk about what went before. So that's a different kind of taboo, not one that's a manipulative kind of narrative control, but that perhaps in the past was simply a psychological recovery process from what had happened.
Do you personally believe that Jesus was in India?
Thank you for that question. Personally, I believe it's entirely possible. I mean, firstly, there's a huge gap in what we know about Jesus, more or less from when he was born, from when he began his teaching ministry. We know he was in Egypt. We don't know what he was doing while he was growing up. We're really just not told. It's entirely possible that he traveled. The world was very travelable at that time due to the Pax Romana. So it's possible that he traveled. It's possible that he was a scholar and traveled in order to study and to learn things. Those who wrote for him were certainly very well educated in international thought. We can see that in the way they've constructed their writings and in the cultural references they make. Was Jesus like that? Was he as au fait with world thought as those who wrote for him? Was he au fait with it because he was a reader, because he was a traveler? We don't know. I think it's entirely possible. I think the church has struggled with it being entirely possible because the church has wanted to have the monopoly of information about Jesus. It wants to be the conduit, the only conduit to Jesus and God. And so if some country over here says, yes, but we've got stories about Jesus too, the church doesn't really want to know about that for that reason. I think that there are different levels of controversy around the question. Traveling between the age of 0 and 30 isn't really controversial, other than that ability to control the narrative, but it's the stories about Jesus in India after what we understand to be the time of his death and resurrection that sort of puts the cat among the pigeons. Do I believe it? I think we have to understand that we are looking at a world of narrative traditions. And it's not that the mainstream Christian Orthodox view is the one with all the physical proof, and these others are just stories. They are all just stories. Even if you're shown a place and told this is where he was born, or this is the house he lived in, or this is where he preached such and such a sermon, that is a narrative tradition. That isn't physical proof. That's a narrative tradition. How do we weigh one against the other? Because one narrative tradition becomes the mainstream, becomes orthodoxy, does that invalidate every other story? So I'm interested from that point of view. Has my thinking shifted? Well, as I've looked at the topic of the possibility of Jesus in India, It's taken me back to the stories in the Gospels of the crucifixion and the resurrection. And I think it is possible that there is another story hidden even within the canonical texts, hints of a survival story rather than what we normally call resurrection. Another way my thinking has changed is that through my study, I've now realized there isn't a single resurrection tradition in the New Testament, that what the Apostle Paul meant by resurrection is not the same as what Matthew, Luke, and John meant by it. So Matthew, Luke, and John, they put forward the view that becomes orthodoxy of Jesus who dies in the normal way, and then through some anomalous miracle, some supernatural intervention, his body is reanimated in a way that becomes indestructible. It is a physical body that can meet with people, can cook meals, can eat and drink. There's something different about it because he seems to walk through walls. There's something different about it because his body will now not age, will not decompose. It is indestructible. So that's the Matthew, Luke, and John version of resurrection. And that is not what the Apostle Paul means by resurrection at all. When he uses that word, he's using Greek language for a Greek concept whereby we're beings of consciousness. We begin as aspects of the consciousness of the cosmos. Then we individuate, have a material experience as a material being. And then we go beyond this life to something unimaginably different as spiritual entities or spiritual bodies, is Paul's language. So whether you take the Pauline view of resurrection or that other one that became orthodoxy, you're going to handle these stories of Jesus in other places differently. The orthodox view sort of makes it impossible for Jesus to have a life in other places and then to pass away at the age of 80, which is the claim of Rosa Ball in Kashmir. But the Pauline story, well, that would fit differently. So I've really been on a journey of exploring these themes and realizing there are more possibilities than I thought. I've also become more aware of the extent to which the gospel writers are using Greco-Roman tropes in the way they tell Jesus' story. And so now I'm more conscious of the fact that Mark, ending his gospel with an empty tomb, as he does in the original version of Mark's gospel, that really is a Greco-Roman trope to say that Jesus has now ascended. He's now to be found among the gods. And the beginning of the gospel says that is where this book is going. That's the conclusion we're going to reach. So if these things are tropes, we have to ask, well, is a trope fiction? Is it fact? Do we say the Christian trope is true and the others are fake? So I think there are more possibilities than I thought when I set out on my Jesus in India journey. And so when I produce the new video, it will take more of that journey into account. If the Platonic story, the Greek story, is true, resurrection is just part of all our experience. It's something we can all look forward to. We've come into this material world to have material experiences, to be enriched by them, to have as good an experience as we can, and then we'll go on to something unimaginably different. And I find that to be a more compelling, more empowering story. The one that says, better stay on the right side of God, leaves us very open to manipulation by religious authorities. And it's not difficult to find examples of that through the ages. And so that's one of the reasons why I love talking about Jesus in India. A reminder that there are these other Christian narratives that have been there from the beginning. Narratives that are not designed to manipulate and terrify, but to inspire, to invite us to explore, and to have the most extraordinary human experience possible. If you enjoy exploring the kind of topics that we explore on The Fifth Kind, on the Paul Wallace Channel, and in my Eden series, then Ancient Knowledge Academy is the learning community for you. A learning community for people who are exploring questions of human origins, human potential, and our place in the cosmos. We've been told ancient texts about the gods are just myths. Close encounters and anomalous experiences are just fantasy. And ancient wisdom is just irrelevant.
But what if the knowledge of our ancestors is not just a reservoir of information about the past, but a roadmap to a better and bigger human experience? Ancient Knowledge Academy is an opportunity for more intentional community, more immersive learning, and a chance to connect with researchers and truth seekers from all around the world. And I will keep our feet on the ground as we explore these stretching topics. And with every subject that we bring to the courses and modules at the Academy, I will always take us to ancestral wisdom and ancient knowledge, believing that what we have in indigenous story and ancestral narratives are resources not just to understand the past, but to understand ourselves in a truer light and equip ourselves for life in the 21st century. Courses at the Academy will include all new material, audio, video, and written resources, and live face-to-face elements so that we can make this learning journey together and in real time. And the Academy enables me to connect more closely with more people who are motivated to make a paradigm-shifting journey and transform their lives. Are you ready? Unlock transformative courses, experience live mentoring sessions, and connect with our global community of seekers. Go to ancientknowledgeacademy.com to begin your journey today.